recording this. If anyone wants, has got an appropriate video camera or whatever, wants to try to record it, feel free. And if you want to contact me later about sending me a copy or whatever, and then I can put it on the web where everybody can see it. But it doesn't look as if anybody's got a little recorder right now. Anyway, I'm not recording my desktop now, just the audio. And I will give you links to where you can look at this, everything I'm showing you. There are videos online, there are web pages online, and so on. So let's just temporarily close this down. So that's my name. And you can easily get hold of my information about me by going to my computer science web page. Now, I wanted to start with that. I want to mention two of the founders of artificial intelligence because I recommend looking them up and just trying what they see what they wrote in the 1960s. So one of them is John McCarthy, and if you go to Google and Wikipedia, you can find a web page for him. He has a lot of papers freely available on his website at Stanford University, and there should be a link to it here somewhere. And the other one is Marvin Minsky. They worked together for a while at MIT. That's an ancient picture. And both died fairly recently. John McCarthy about 6 or 7 years ago, Marvin Minsky early last year. And on Marvin Minsky's web page, you can get his name by typing Marvin Minsky to Google and go to his web page. You find that he also has quite a lot of papers on here. And there's one in particular for any of you who are really thinking about going deeply into artificial intelligence. It was published originally around 1962, and it's called Steps Toward Artificial Intelligence. So there it is, 1960, Steps Toward Artificial Intelligence. And it's available online, and you can read it or print it out or whatever. If you have any trouble, you can always email me and I can tell you how to get hold of these things. That was an amazing paper written about 1962. What's that? 55 years ago or something. And he identified many of the problems that needed to be solved, some of which are still not solved, some have been solved. And I think there are even more problems than he noticed. And that's what I'm going to try to give you a feel for. Some of the one of the interesting things is that already in 1962, he had a bibliography with 95 papers. So there you see the end of the bibliography. You can just about make out the 95 at the bottom there. So there's a mass of stuff. And unfortunately, many of the people working in the field forget all that stuff, and they just learn what their supervisor or their tutors know about and what their supervisors know about. And then the stuff that was done earlier, which is often very deep and has a lot of branching implications, gets ignored. So I'm hoping if any of you really want to go into artificial intelligence in a deep way, look up what Marvin Minsky and John McCarthy did in the 1960s to get a feel for some of the problems. And you'll get a feel, you'll realize that some of the approaches are very different from what you've been learning recently. And you may disagree with what they've written. And you may disagree with what I say, but that's part of what goes on in academic life. There's an online talk of mine, which is a PDF thing. So if you go type to Google Sloman Talk 111, you'll get this thing that refers to, or Sloman Talks will be enough, Sloman Presentations. You can click on it. And it'll take you to this website, and then you can go down and look for things. And near the top, somewhere, go to contents, you'll see talk 111 is near the top, two related themes. Well, I'm going to give you a subset of what's in that. That's a PDF file, should work on any computer. And I'll just be talking about a subset of what's in that. So I'm not going to say as much about vision as there is in there, but I'll say a little about vision. Okay, so Am I audible okay all around the room? Okay, good. One of the things that, as I said earlier, is characteristic of humans is the fact that they use language, and I'm using one now, and there are many languages. Some of you probably already know there are several thousand languages used by humans on this planet. And you can take a child born any part of the planet, and when it's very young, move it to another community, and if it grows up there, it'll end up talking the language that it grows up in. So somehow, biological evolution produced in human brains an ability to develop, notice I'm not going to say learn, to develop a language that's like the one that's being used in the environment where they grow up. And I want to give you a tiny feel for what's involved in that, because I don't, despite all the enormous publicity of what's going about what's been happening in artificial intelligence, about all the statistical learning and so on, there's nothing that comes close to what not only humans but other animals can do in some aspects, and in other ways the machines are way ahead. They do arithmetic and statistics much faster than anything produced by evolution. Okay, when I said talk 111 is about this, there are a whole lot of other talks given at other places on this web page. If you go to it, you're welcome to look at anything there. And send me critical comments, questions, whatever. You can get my email address. Well, I'm in the School of Computer Science, a.sloman. An email to me there will reach me. So let me say something about some controversies about language. The question is what it is and how it evolved. Now, one view about what it is that it's a mechanism for communication between brains. And that's what human languages are used for. It's not the only thing it's used for. If you sit down and compose a sonnet, you might do that without communicating with anybody else. You write an essay or a poem or whatever, or a diary. A lot of what I write is an attempt by me to get my own ideas clear, not necessarily communicating to somebody else. That usually comes out in a later version after I've been struggling. But I want to give another view of language. I'll come back to communication. But I want to talk about what happens when you see things, or when an elephant sees things, or when a newborn, or a very young child sees things. Let's look at a video of some elephants, which I've got here. Now, they've gone into a water hole. I'm starting in the middle. If you go to Google and type YouTube elephants, baby elephants rescue, you get something like this. There are several. You can see there are big elephants and there's water, and what you can't see is there's a baby elephant. I'll start in the middle of the video. That's stuck there. You can probably, yeah, it's just, and the water's rushing by quite fast. So the two adult elephants, they're almost certainly females, one might be an older sister and the other the mother, are trying to get that baby out, and you can see the other elephants have gone out via a sort of ramp going out of the water there. And they're pushing it round until it's close to that ramp, and then eventually you'll see the baby going out. It's going out between the others, and the others keep close around it. Well, you can ask yourself, what were the adults doing there? They have eyes, they have trunks, they don't have hands. Their trunks can be moved around in very complicated ways. They use them to pick up food and put it in their mouth. But they seem, judging by what you can see in the video, they seem to be aware that the baby elephant is in trouble, that it can't, on its own, cope with the rushing water and get back to the ramp which it'll need to get to in order to get out, because it can't climb up a steep bank there. So they're gently guiding and pushing, and I couldn't tell from the video myself how much pushing they need to do and how much it was just guiding and pointing in the right direction. I think there's probably some pushing as well in other videos I've seen. I haven't seen this in real life myself, but there are quite a lot of videos. In other videos I've seen the mother or other adult elephant actually pushing a child because the slope that it's got to go up is too steep. Pushing with a trunk, and in some cases gently pushing with a tusk at the back. So, can an elephant do that without any language? Well, they can do it without a human language, and they can do it without communicating with one another in sounds the way we do when we communicate, but it's quite clear that there are a number of things going on there. First of all, there's some sort of collaboration between the larger and the medium-sized elephant. I think each of them knew what the other was doing, and at various stages they were on opposite sides of the child. But I want to just think about what's going on in one elephant. The elephant's taking in a lot of visual information about what's happening in the environment. What does that mean? Sounds are going in through its ears. If you look at sound recordings on a graphical display, it's just waveforms. So the elephant's brain is doing something to, as our brains do when you hear speech or anything else, to find structure in that acoustic pattern. Well, what sort of structure? Well, it must be taking in, sorry, I said acoustic pattern, it could be a visual pattern as well because they've got eyes. So there's a lot of information coming in, signals going to the brain. There must be in some way, not just saying, oh, I've got all these photons hitting my retina and sound waves hitting my eardrums, but there are things happening outside me and I'm getting information about those things. And what are those things? Well, there are surfaces. I can see this surface that I'm about to put my hand on. Some of you couldn't see it now. And if I hold this up, you can see that it's roughly rectangular, and you may or may not be able to see how many surfaces it's got, but you can get an idea from the shape that you see that it's got one surface on top, one on the bottom, one on each side, one facing you, and one at the back. So you can work, you can in some sense get information about what the structure is without necessarily seeing all that structure. None of you have so far seen the surface on this side, but you know it's there. In fact, you can see roughly where it is from where my finger stops moving. Okay? So seeing involves getting information about structures in the environment. What information? Well, I've been telling you what sort of information. There are surfaces, but they're not only surfaces, there are things that those surfaces are part of. Like, there's a surface of a baby elephant, which is one of the places you can push it if you want it to move. There are surfaces of the riverbank, surfaces of the path that you can go on to climb out. So, for animals and non-human animals and human animals and other intelligent animals, for them to do what they do, they make nests, they look after their young, they get food, they come back to their nests, they may attack something that they want to eat, which is mobile. Some animals feed on berries and grass and so on, and it doesn't run away. But if you feed on deer, then it tends to run away. So you have to run after that. And that means you've got to not only see where it is, but where it's going. Get information about motion of things, not just where the surfaces are. So long before there were humans on the planet, there were lots of animals that had to feed themselves. They had to move around avoiding obstacles. If they had offspring, they had to either look after them if they were with them, like the elephant baby, Or if they left them in a nest, as birds do and many other animals do, they had to know where they are in the environment in relation to the nest in order to be able to go back with whatever food they've got and so on. So they have to take in information about the fact that they're inside a large space. That space has objects of many kinds. Those objects have surfaces and parts. They may have motions, and they have relationships to one another. And they may also have properties like being edible, which you won't necessarily see, but you learn another way. They may have properties like being mobile. This thing isn't mobile on its own, but if I let go of it, it's mobile under the influence of gravity. But a rabbit doesn't need gravity, it'll run away from you because it's got a store of energy and muscles and so on. So what's this got to do with language? I said I was going to talk about language. Can anyone see any connection with language? The question is, what is the brain doing with all that information? It can't just keep videos or images in there, because then there'd be a problem. What do you do with the images? You've got to get information out of the images of the sort that I've been giving you in words. There's this thing and that thing and this surface and that surface, and like if I move in this direction, I can block that motion, or if I push over here, I can make a thing move that way. All of these things are examples of information you can get from what you see. So what I'm suggesting is that long before there were any human beings on this planet, and even now, where there are many non-human animals on this planet, there are animals, intelligent animals, that take in information about the environment and have to have it inside them in a form which allows them to reason with, to take decisions, to consider options for action, to select what to do. So what I'm suggesting is that needs something like a language. I don't mean strings of English words. It might be some other kind of language. In fact, I don't think anyone knows exactly what sort of language an elephant has, or a crow has, or a nest-building bird has. But they must have something which not only enables them to see what's there, but to see what can happen, what will change if they do this. Squirrels are amazing in some of the things they do. Have any of you seen squirrels trying to fight with a bird feeder that's meant to feed birds but not squirrels? But if you go to YouTube and type squirrel-proof bird feeder, you can see videos of squirrels looking at this bird feeder, working out what to do, and then taking action of a kind that requires possibly going in another direction away from this bird feeder and then coming at it from above, or jumping up to it and catching it and so on. Anyway, I won't elaborate on that. So if this is correct, and we go back to what language is, I'm going to say there were three views about the evolution of human language, and one of them is that there were first expressive noises, like grunts or whatever, which became more differentiated and then eventually turned into words and sentences of the kind we now have. And only after that kind of development could people think, what shall I do next? Which is the best way to go? Can I catch that rabbit for lunch? Because those thoughts need something like a language. So if the language starts only through communication, then you can't have any thoughts until you've communicated. Does anyone believe you can't have any thoughts, that animals that can't communicate can't have any thoughts? Most animals that seem to be intelligent have thoughts which seem to me to be richer than what they communicate, and that's true of humans as well. What you see in this environment has much more detail. The pattern of motions of my hand now that you're seeing is something you can't describe because you don't have words specifically for it. You can say, well, I moved my hands roughly upwards and around in circles, but that's less than you saw. So an alternative is that before language was used to communicate, there was internal languages that were used for another purpose. But some people thought that something else happened. Namely, there were not vocal languages, but expressive languages that were used signs. Why? Well, you use your hands for doing things, for feeding yourself, for looking after your children, and other animals use their paws and trunks and whatever. So they're using those parts of themselves to interact with the environment. Perhaps they started using them to interact with other members of the same species. Now, do any of you know any deaf people who use sign language? Okay. If you go, again, YouTube's great, go and look for deaf signing or whatever, and you'll see that when deaf people communicate with a sign language, there's an awful lot going on. Both hands moving, head maybe moving, mouth moving and so on. And the human sign language is very rich, and as rich as any spoken language, it's just different. It may even be richer because it's got this multimodal communication. Nobody here has learnt a sign language. Well, I'm going to tell you something you didn't know. Well, you may or may not have known. If you had been exposed when very young to a community of signers, you'd have picked up that language just as well as you pick up any spoken language. Humans have that ability. And there's a spectacular story about deaf children in Nicaragua. Has anyone heard about them? Okay. In some communities, well, nowadays, I guess in most communities with deaf people, the young children are taught a sign language, and they become very fluent with it and so on. But in some communities, it was thought to be a bad thing, because they were in a minority, and the thought was, children should learn to lip read. But that's very difficult to do. Lips don't have enough, the motion of lips and faces and so on, don't have enough structure to get the information that's communicated verbally. And as a result, the children in those societies did not grow up with much linguistic competence, and their cognitive development was retarded. And this was noticed in Nicaragua, and at some point, I think 30, 40 years ago, the government decided they're going to change the policy and teach all deaf children sign language from a very early age. But they didn't have many teachers. Has anyone heard the rest of the story? Well, what do you do if you don't have many teachers and you've got many children? You bring the children to the teachers. So they brought them all into one place, and teachers, I think there were very few teachers, I don't know how many, started communicating in sign language with these children, young children, who picked up the sign language. And then after a while, the teachers were totally confused and amazed, because these kids seemed to be signing to one another and laughing and doing all sorts of things that the teachers just couldn't understand. So they brought linguists and anthropologists from universities in other countries, I think from MIT in one place, to come and work, understand what was going on. And it turned out that the language that the teachers had acquired, the deaf teachers, the sign language they had acquired, was not very rich, because they acquired it fairly late, and they didn't acquire it in a community of signers who were using sign language all the time while they were young and growing up. So what they were trying to teach the children wasn't good enough for the children. So what did they do? Quite spontaneously, they created a richer language and started using it with them amongst themselves. I may be able to show you a bit of a video just for showing part of it.
After the Nicaraguan Revolution, the new government tried to enhance deaf people's lives. It brought deaf village children into Managua to end their isolation. Here, educators tried to teach them an existing sign language. the effort failed. The children showed little interest in learning a language forced upon them. Instead, they began communicating with each other in their own way.
So what's going on?
Judy Kegel was summoned from the United States to sort out the problem.
I came down thinking wherever there were deaf people, there was a sign language, and that obviously there would be
You can see this is called The Birth of a New Sign Language in Nicaragua. If you want to watch the whole video, you can find it on YouTube. But I've given you the crucial bits. But there's something I haven't said explicitly. What does that tell us about a newborn baby, a newborn human baby, and what must be in the human genome, a product of biological evolution? Not just what most people think, namely an ability to learn a language that's already in use, but an ability to create a new language if surrounded by others of the same species. And that's what these children did. And what I will suggest is that every normal child who grows up in, any normal human child who grows up in a context where there is spoken language is also creating a language, but in this case the child's in a minority. So the child creates is very close to what the adults are already doing. It's not just collecting lots of statistical data and then trying to find the patterns, which is what many people are trying to get computers to do now, and they're having some progress. As a result of using that technique, Google Speak will enable you to talk into a search engine and ask for something, and it's been trained on many, many examples of human language, but it didn't learn the human language the way a human learned it by starting with a rich genetic makeup, which has the ability to create a language, but not just to create this language that's talked over here, but to create any one of several thousand languages which are very different in their structure. And they can differ not only in the kinds of sounds they use, which consonants they use, which vowels they use, and so on, but also whether it's a vocal language or a sign language or a written language. The written language is used as well. So there's something very deep and powerful that's in there, not necessarily fully operational at birth, but somehow as the child's brain develops, something that's in its genetic heritage begins, probably starts working within the first year, but goes on doing more and more complicated things for the next few years. Initially, for a hearing child, be trying to pick up the kinds of sounds, so children start making noises. In a deaf community, the children probably start making movements instead of the noises. And then gradually these things take shape. But later they start developing a grasp of grammatical structure and learning that there are different kinds of words, like there are different, there is a different kind of word from are, and are is a different kind of word, it's a verb, a different kind of word from there, and different is different from the others, it's an adjective, kinds of, and so on, kind is a noun. So the word, words of your language, the parts of a language are made of different kinds of parts with different grammatical structures which refer to different sorts of things. Some may refer to actions, some may refer to objects, some may refer to relationships, some may refer to the difference between asking a question and making an assertion. So if I say, please tell me which is the way to go, that's different from saying that's the way to go. Right, so going back to three views about human language. The first was there are expressive noises, and then gradually they became richer noises, and I'm now suggesting that's unlikely. Another version is there were first expressive gestures and then there were noises. And what I've said so far is consistent with that. There might have been a sign language and it became very rich and powerful. But it's not very good at night in the dark. It's also not very good when you're communicating with someone around the corner. And also if you're trying to do something complicated and you want to collaborate, if you have to move your hands around, it may be impossible to continue what you're doing at the same time as you're communicating. So there are lots of reasons why going from a sign language to a vocal language provides advantages. Nighttime communication, communication around corners, and simultaneous communication and performing complex actions. But there's a third possibility, which I think is there in the evidence from elephants and other intelligent animals, which is that language evolved first for internal use. There's perceptual mechanisms, taking in information, for perceiving, thinking, forming goals, forming questions, planning, controlling actions. And there are many animals that seem to be able to do things like that, like those elephants that worked out that the baby needed help and worked out what to do about it. They were not expressing these thoughts in actions to, that communicated between one another, or they seemed to, the two adults that seemed to understand what was going on and to share the task. But in order to get that far, they must already have had internally an understanding of what's going on. Well, it's not enough just to have an internal video. You must have something richer. You must have parts that say, this thing's this baby. The baby's in a stream where the water's rushing. The baby needs to go that way, but it's going that way. Or whatever kinds of things the elephants thought. It may have had thoughts that I can't express in English, but something that decomposes the situation and allows ideas to develop, like, this baby is here facing that way, moving that way. This baby needs to face that way, go that way. What do I have to do to help it go that? Go around the far side and push, or whatever the elephants did. So what I'm suggesting then is that there were internal representations which any animal needs in order to perceive complex scenes. So that'll be nest-building birds, hunting mammals, birds that graze, they have to see where to go to get the next lump of grass or whatever. And internally, they have to have a language which has parts. Parts can be assembled to form different thoughts, different percepts, different intentions, different questions, different generalizations that can be saved and reused later. And then at some later stage, these internal things were associated with communications between individuals, and that definitely happened in human history, and it seems to have happened to a lesser extent in some other animals that seem to be able to collaborate, but they can't communicate in with grammatical structures the way humans do. And I'm not saying that the evolutionary mechanisms produce a fixed internal language. It may be that that language grows in ways that depend on what you're interacting with. A child that's growing up playing with Meccano and Lego and computers and dolls and dogs and so on may develop different internal languages from one that's growing up living in a cave where there are rocks and sand and mud and trees and nothing like the toys that you encountered as kids. So that raises a whole lot of deep questions about what kind of general power is in the genome that enables children, our ancestors and their ancestors and so on, and children growing up now in different, very different parts of the planet, to all acquire ways of thinking, ways of seeing, ways of forming intentions that are relevant to the environments that they're in. It'll be some time before robots can do anything remotely like that, but maybe one, some of you will come up with great new ideas about how to make that happen. Let's change tack a bit about the structure of a language. Okay. You've met chatbots, presumably. This one is written in a language called Pop11. It's called Eliza. The basic idea was there about 1960, very early, or late 1960s, early 1970s. I can say I am demonstrating you to a lecture class or something. Okay. I hadn't planned that in advance. I have no idea what's going to come out. The system will take that in, and this kind of chatbot just has a collection of stored patterns and tries to match the input sequences of words against patterns, and if it recognizes something, that may trigger a response.
What if you were not really demonstrating me to a lecture class?
Okay. So it sounded as if it understood and was asking a question about it, but I happen to know how this thing works, and I can tell you that it only noticed I am and recognized that and saw there's something after that. And in there, there's a rule that says if what the person types in, I am blah, 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 then you can say, what if you were not blah, blah, blah? I'm going to test that. This may not work because it's random the way it works. It doesn't always get the same rule. But I'll say, I am quite a lot of rubbish.
I wonder if you are an intelligent computer.
I'll try again. I am blah, 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 blah.
Is your brain some kind of computer?
Not working.
What made you start thinking that way about yourself?
Okay, this demonstration isn't working. Let's try a variant. You have failed this test.
Why do you say that?
Okay, well, if I went on, I'd be able to show you more of the structure of the patterns there, but because it's random, I can't tell which rule is going to be triggered. And sometimes it'll just say something that's totally unrelated to what I've typed in. And I was hoping it would find patterns in there and demonstrate what's going on. But there's a quite different kind of thing, which I had started preparing somewhere here. And if I never mind, I'll just start it again. Okay, this is a program, it's quite old, which is a simple version of a very famous program that was written by Terry Winograd around 1971 for a PhD thesis at MIT when AI was in its infancy. And it enables me to type something in, and the program has a much deeper understanding of what I type than the Eliza program did. I'm going to get some examples so I don't have to type them. So if I type help, I'll get some examples. So I don't know how much you can see on the screen, but I'll read everything out. There's a collection of sentences here. Put a green block on a blue block, move the little red block onto a big green block. Okay, I'll try and move the little red block onto a big green block. So it's copied it down there, moves the little red block onto a big green block. I don't know if you can see that. It's small print. Sorry about that. And it has analyzed it into a structure which is shown here in terms of lists of lists of lists, which you can't see. But if I click on continue, it shows you how it's analyzed it. So I typed, move the little red block onto a big green block, and it's broken that up into parts, which are made of parts. So it's recognized that move is a verb, and then it's recognized that this whole thing is a verb phrase with a verb which has a noun phrase, the thing to be moved, and then a prepositional phrase which says something about where it's to be moved, so it's an onto PP. And this prepositional phrase has the word, a determiner, which is there, and a noun phrase, so the little red block. And that's a simple noun phrase which has got an adjectival phrase, which has got two adjectives, little and red are adjectives, and they're labeled as adjectives. And this is an adjectival phrase, and then there's a bigger adjectival phrase with two, so red would be an adjectival phrase, little red is also an adjectival phrase. And then block is a noun, so the adjectives come before the block together with the to specify that there's a unique individual, the little red block. And that's what's to be moved. And then over here, there's this other thing, which is a prepositional phrase, an onto prepositional phrase, which specifies where it's to be moved. And onto, here's a preposition. There's a noun phrase saying onto what? Onto A, that's a determiner which is not specific the way the is. So when there's the, there should be only one thing that satisfies the description. But now it says A, so you can choose one. A big green block. Anyway, the program has had to start with a collection of rules about how you can put things together to form phrases like adjectival phrases, noun phrases, prepositional phrases, and how those can be put together to form sentences. And when I type this thing in, it has to use that knowledge in order to break down the sentence. Now, am I right in thinking that so far in your AI course, you haven't been taught anything about natural language or grammars or parsing? Okay. This is not necessarily a fashionable thing nowadays, but I think everybody should know something about it. And if you want, you can read more and teach yourself. But I will just show you what it does next. So it translates that stuff that I showed you there into an internal database where it says there's the word put followed by the word the, and then there's a description, something that's a block, A, and the size of A is small and the color is red, so that A little red block. And then it's on something else, A is a block, A size large, A color green, A. This is A refers to something else. So in the one case, it's got to find a small red block. In the other case, it's got to find a large green block. And then what it's got to do is use the verb at the front, put, to work out what to do with it. And I'm running out of time, and you will get anxious. So I'll just bring this to a conclusion. It works out a plan to achieve the goal. And you can see it's got put small red on big green. And in order to do that, it's got to move the hand around, and it's got to get things out of the way. So it's got to move a small blue block off the big green block, which it's done. And now I can get the little red block and move it onto the green block, and then it's done. So you can see there that it had an internal language for representing what had been said, which was different from the external language. The internal language represented the structure of what was said, and then using that, it could relate that to what it already knew about what was in the scene, because it's got this fake visual system. And it was able to bring about a state of affairs by using the language which specifies an end state. The little red block is on the big green block. To work out a plan, which is also expressed in its internal language, to pick one thing up and move it somewhere else and then let go. But in doing that, it had to move the hand first above the first thing and then go down and grasp and then up and along and so on. So it's using linguistic capabilities internally, not just to specify what's out there, but to work out what to do and how to do it in some detail. And textbooks that were popular in the 1970s and 1980s went into a lot of that. It became unfashionable because people thought all of that work is designed by humans and really we should let the find ways to get the computers to train themselves. And so the fashion moved to a lot more learning from examples. And that's, you've probably learned a lot about that and you learn more about that. But what I'm saying is that something important is in danger of being lost, and you can learn about it yourselves. It may come up a later part in your course, I'm not sure. But if not, you have to go to older textbooks and read about natural language processing and scene analysis and how internal languages are used to express what a language is and what the rules of the language are. And internal languages are used to express what's in a perceived scene. And internal languages are used to form intentions. And internal languages are used to form plans. And when you've got all those rich internal languages, you can do things that you can't do if all you've got is a large collection of measurements, numbers, images, you will find some of what I'm talking about in the course material you're getting later on, but you may have to go on your own to get beyond it. Okay, this collection of slides that I started, I've shown you the first three, well, not the first three, there are three in the middle, about three views of language, and there's a lot more in there about that fills in details. So if you do what I mentioned earlier, which is go to that webpage, Aaron Sloman Talks, and look for Talk 111, you'll get this PDF file, and it says a lot of what I've just said, but it goes into a lot more detail about language and about vision. And you can email me, there's my name on the slides, and if you want to ask questions, I don't mind then trying to answer, or we can arrange a meet. I may have to come in specially because I do a lot of work at home, being retired. I don't do much teaching. Any urgent questions now? Okay. Well, good luck with the rest of your course. I hope you enjoy it. And maybe some of you will solve deep problems that nobody can right now about how vision works, about how language works, and about how babies learn things, and how to get robots to do the same thing. Thank you.